Hey everybody, and welcome to the IAAF Inside Athletics podcast. My name's Ben Harlow, and I'm joined by my co-host, Katie Smith.
Hello, nice to be here. And throughout the year, we're going to be bringing you the latest news and talking points in the world of athletics. We'll also be reaching out and giving in-depth and exclusive interviews with some of your favourite athletes from across the globe.
Now, as you can probably tell, there's been a little bit of a shake-up with the format and structure of the podcast. We've listened to your feedback, and we're really dedicated to bringing you the best quality content possible. So just a little bit about me. My name's Ben, and I am a huge athletics geek. I've loved athletics since, I don't know, I remember the first Olympics I probably watched was 2004 Athens, seeing Kelly Holmes get the double gold was insane, and then I was hooked ever since, pretty much. And now I work for the IAAF editorial team.
And I'm Katie. I'm a sports journalist and broadcaster and a huge lover of athletics. I used to go every year from about the age of four to the Crystal Palace meet in London and saw the likes of Jonathan Edwards. And I saw Usain Bolt there before he won his first gold in Beijing, before he was as big as he is now, which was very exciting.
Still acting crazy on the start line though.
He was. There was a false start. And it took them so long to figure out who'd done it and sort it all out. And Usain was just sat on his blocks singing and dancing.
Some things never change.
And at that point, obviously, no one really got it yet. So I think they just thought he was that weird Jamaican who didn't really know what was going on.
So, coming up on today's podcast, we're going to talk to you about all things Commonwealth Games. We're going to talk briefly about the IAAF Gender Agenda campaign and Women's History Month. We're also going to talk race walking as well, ahead of the IAAF World Race Walking Team Championships.
As well as that, we'll be touching on, obviously, the showpiece event of athletics in the summer, which is the Diamond League starting in May. We'll be going over the scoring system, how it all works, and, of course, the road to the final at the end.
Ooh, exciting.
Yes, and, of course, Ben, you have been catching up with one of, I think, global athletics' favourite stars.
Oh, my God.
Valerie Adams.
What a woman.
So we're going to be talking to her later in the show, as well as speaking to a really incredible person, Iñaki Gomez, who is the chair of the Athletes Commission.
So let's talk about the Commonwealth Games first, because it's been so exciting, there's been so much going on. What's been your favourite moment so far?
Oh, that's a tough one. It's been great just seeing young athletes coming through, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
For me, though, obviously a member of the old guard, Caster Semenya, going for the double in the 800 and the 1500. Seen her dominating the 800 so much recently. She's a very strong athlete. But really nice to see her going for a more tactical race in the 1500, not taking it out from the front, but still winning and using that strength. And I think she's a real ambassador for younger athletes coming through and what races they were.
Yeah, I also saw she said as well that from now onwards, she plans to do the double for Doha 2019 and Tokyo 2020 for the 800 and the 1500.
I mean, does anyone else have a chance?
I don't know. I mean, she's also talked about going and doing distance races like further, like 5K, 10K.
Wow.
Yeah. So she's not messing around.
That would be really interesting to see, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I do wonder how she would fare in a proper long distance race. It'd be interesting for the future. Speaking of standout performances, I think for me as well, it was nice to see Shaunae Miller-Uibo come back from, obviously, disappointment in London last year. Was leading the 400 metres and then ended up coming fourth. Only got a bronze in the 200 metres. She had a nice finish with the Diamond League, winning them both in the end, but she didn't get the championship medals, and now she's kind of come away from the Commonwealths with a gold medal in a really high-quality field.
And she looked supreme while she was doing it.
Her semi-final, she jogged the whole way.
I just love watching her run, and she's, I know everyone says it, but with that 400-metre backing behind her, the final 100 metres of the 200 is just so strong.
Yeah.
You can just see a strong path. I thought Dina Asher-Smith of England was really great, had a phenomenal bend and start, but it's just that little extra something that Miller's got in the final third that I just thought was brilliant to see.
And also seeing Sharika, that like 400 metre runner, again, turned into a 200 metre runner. Where did that come from? And then Elaine Thompson fourth.
Elaine Thompson, yeah, we've got to speak about that. There's been a lot of buzz around her on Twitter in this past week at the Commies, because people are saying she's a flaky athlete, double Olympic champion, now fourth place at the Commonwealth Games. I mean, what do you make of her?
I don't think flaky is fair. I think if you look at it in the grand scheme of things, silver in the 200 metres back in Beijing in 2015, then 2016 double Olympic champion. Within the space of 8 months in London and the Commonwealth and the World Indoors, she's just had a few rubbish meets consecutively. And it's only been in the space of the year. We've just had a lot of championships. And unfortunately, she's been one of the athletes that, I guess, hasn't really been able to do the double for, like, World Indoors and Commonwealths.
Mm. And I suppose it's worth us talking about the fact that the Commonwealth Games are absurdly early for most athletes this year, aren't they?
I guess they're in the Southern Hemisphere, so we're always going to have that divide on when is the best time to do it. When's the best time to hold them? Because, you know, in a few months' time, it's going to be rainy and colder in Australia and New Zealand, that kind of thing. So it's April or it's October. And I guess because of that, I guess the performances of the Northern Hemisphere athletes tend to dip.
Mm. But isn't it funny that Southern Hemisphere athletes have to adjust to that so much more?
Yeah, I mean, they have to deal with it every year. Mm. So I guess every so often, swapping it around...
But it was interesting you were saying about, so the doubling with the World Indoors, which was only a month ago, really. An athlete that springs to mind who was successful was obviously Katarina Johnson-Thompson in the pentathlon to the heptathlon.
There's other athletes who doubled up as well. Like we mentioned, Elaine Thompson, but she didn't get any metal. But Kimberly Williams, triple jump. She's got a gold at the Commonwealth along with her silver. Yes. Along with that, Danielle Thomas-Dodd in the shot put. She beat Dame Valerie Adams. Crazy, but she also got silver as well back in Birmingham. So there's been people like Luvo Manyonga as well, silver in Birmingham. A lot of silvers in Birmingham, they've righted it back, they've changed silver to gold.
And arguably the most impressive double of them all was actually Tom Walsh of New Zealand in the men's shot put.
Yeah, definitely. It's an interesting season. It's different from... I like the fact that it spices it up a little bit, and it gives these Southern Hemisphere nations a chance to shine, and it's been nice seeing Australia having a moment to, you know, properly display their athletics team, because they've had a belter of a championship. They've done really, really well. Speaking of athletes who've doubled up with World Indoors and Commonwealths, obviously, Katarina Johnson-Thompson in the heptathlon wasn't like a crazy good score for her, but she did seem like she was injured towards the end of it. But I thought what was particularly interesting was the athlete who got the bronze medal, Niamh Emerson of England. There's a photo, it was put on the IAAF Twitter account, you can probably find it at IAAF.org, if none of you do follow it. But there was a photo put out last summer where Niamh Emerson watched Katarina Johnson-Thompson in the heptathlon as a fan, just watching her idol compete. And now, 8 months later, she's standing on the podium with her.
That's great.
18 years old, what a crazy turnaround. That's so cool. So... will be interesting to see where that goes in the future. Also, the only other thing that I really want to talk about with the Commonwealth Games is Jamaica in the distance races and Kenya having like 400 metre finalists. This is crazy.
What is going on? It's shaken up. I mean, I think maybe Jamaica have actually come to that realisation now that Usain Bolt's gone. Johan Blake really... It annoyed me how much pressure I think people were putting on him to be this... filling the space of Usain Bolt. I don't think he's been his best for a very long time.
And I never really got people trying to put him in that position because he hasn't really been performing to that kind of standard for a few years now.
Absolutely. But what I think they have realised is that their national sport can no longer just be sprinting. You know, it's like a subsection of the athletics. They now need to branch out. You know, they clearly have pedigree within the track and field world.
Mm.
There's so much potential there, and we've seen with the likes of Danielle Thomas-Dodd.
And the shot put, Kimberly Williams in the triple jump.
Yeah, Aisha Prawleer in the steeplechase. I mean, where did that come from?
And also, they've got some great male throwers as well who've got medals at the Commonwealth. I mean,
Frederick Dakers today won.
Yeah.
I can't say today. Frederick Dakers won gold in the men's discus as well.
So it's been cool to see a mix of nations getting different medals and, you know, not conforming to the stereotypes of athletics, I guess.
I love it, though, don't you?
Yeah,
I think
no,
that's really great to see.
Definitely, and it is, I guess, it's the epitome of what the Commonwealth Games is about.
So now I think we should touch on the IAAF gender agenda, which was focused around last month's Women's History Month, which looked at women within athletics. So I don't just mean the athletes, but it was looking at women in positions of power within athletics. That could be management and coaching, people behind the scenes. And for me, one thing that has always stood out, and I think one of the reasons I really love athletics, is that from a viewer's perspective, from a fan's perspective, there is gender parity. I don't believe that people have an issue watching, say, a women's race compared to a men's race.
No, I feel definitely the excitement
is always there in the high jump, in the pole vault, all of these things. That it does not matter. You just want a good race and you want the stars, whether they're men or women. And I don't think you necessarily get that in all sports. I would love to see that, but there are still issues, I know, particularly in Britain, with things like football.
Yeah.
There's still a complete disparity in that.
I agree.
I don't know, is that something that drew you to athletics as well?
I think so. I think it sounds cliche to say, but I almost didn't see gender within the sport because it was such a non-thing. It's just, this athlete is great in the event that they do. And you don't really think about how a man is running faster than a woman, or you know, a man is throwing further than a woman. You don't think about it like that. You just, as you said, you just think of it as a competition. Like, what a great competition. Like, at the World Championships last year, the women's 3,000-meter steeplechase was insane. The best race by a mile. And it had nothing to do
with... And there were no men involved. But no, so I think it's a really important campaign, and if you want some more in-depth stuff, there's quite a lot on the website.
Yeah, there is loads on the website. So there's features on Kelly Southerton and Dion Hemmings about how you can go from an athlete to becoming a coach, or just being a coach in general, being a female coach within the sport.
And another point just within that I think is so interesting is, perhaps in the next few years, seeing more women coaching men, not just women coaching women.
Yeah, well, Wade Van Nieker, coached by his grandmother. Exactly. And I think we'll see a lot more of that in the future. There's also the likes of the broadcasters within the sport. Catherine Merry had a really interesting piece in there. There's also sports marketing consultants as well. For Seiko, Susan Bouvier-Pickles had a really interesting piece. And there's also, really interestingly as well, athlete management, which you don't really think about, or it doesn't really cross your mind, but managers play such a key role within the sport, you just don't even realise it.
I think athlete management is really important for women, and probably an area that has never really been targeted as a female-specific thing, but this is what people are trying to do now, because management is all about welfare, it's about marketing athletes in the way that they want to be seen, in the way that they should be seen, and making sure that they're okay with everything that's going on. And I think women have their own needs that are different from men, especially in worlds where, like sport, where they are quite masculine and male dominated. It's really important that we cater for that.
I just think in general it's a great campaign, and if you're interested, then yeah, head to the website, because there's so much to read. And I think one of the best quotes of it came from Catherine Merry, and she just said, "There isn't any role that can't be done more efficiently and effectively simply based on whether you're male or female." And I think that just sums it up perfectly. So, you know, if you are a girl, woman, whatever, looking to get into the sport, don't let the fact that it's, you know, male dominated affect your ambition.
So the marathons have been taking centre stage in the last few weeks of the athletics calendar. We move from glorious scenes on the Gold Coast to what can only be described as torrential storms in Boston. And then, of course, the hottest marathon on record in London just a few days ago. So in Boston, great racing despite the flooding on the roads and the cagoules and anoraks we saw lining the streets. And, of course, the athletes themselves having to wrap up warm for those kinds of conditions. But Desi Linden, the nearly girl, the bridesmaid of American distance running, managed to secure her first win at Boston, and she is the first female American winner of that race in over three decades. So really an historic day. But what was so nice to see was, of course, that interaction with Shalane Flanagan, who had to stop for a toilet break halfway through the race. Desi waited for her and they ran together. Then in the men's race, we had another surprise but great winner in Yuki Kawauchi from Japan. He is in fact not a professional runner. He has a day job working for the government, but he was brilliant to watch and said afterwards that for him it's about the freedom of the running and not having sponsors and being paid. So I thought that just added a really nice extra touch to that race, and so impressive from him that he was able to outclass the rest of the field. Moving on to London then, and again, beautiful blue skies for Mo Farah's first marathon, really. He had a stint in 2014, but this is the first one he's run since retiring from the track, so everyone was intrigued to see what he would be doing. But of course, he was up against some great competition. One name in particular stands out, of course, Eliud Kipchoge, Olympic marathon champion. Almost went under 2 hours last year. He was in supreme form in London, took it out from the front, let the other guys stay with him for the majority of the race, but you always got that sense that he had a little something left over. And of course, he stormed to victory. Not a course record like some expected, perhaps something to do with the conditions, but very convincing. And I think it's fair to say Mo Farah could have his work cut out for him if he is going to try and go for Tokyo 2020, because I think while Kipchoge is around, looking unlikely that anyone can surpass that master. In the women's race as well, we had rumours going around in the build-up, very exciting, thinking that Paula Radcliffe's record of 2:15.25 could be under threat by none other than Mary Keitany, who holds the women's only record. But it wasn't to be again. She went out very, very fast with only Tirunesh Dibaba for company. Paula Radcliffe had mentioned in the build-up that she thought Dibaba might be another threat to the record. But again, she dropped out. Conditions too much, perhaps, the pace too much. Keitany kept it going, but it was ultimately Kenya's Vivian Cheruiyot who took the crown in London on Sunday. She paced it a lot better through the first half of the race, only her third marathon win, but really impressive start. And you could just see, I think it was the moment she overtook Keitany, the speed difference there and the mental difference there. You could see Cheruiyot on the up, Keitany just had nothing left to give. Did finish the race though, but Cheruiyot should not go unmentioned that she has actually clocked the fourth fastest time by a woman ever in the marathon. So it was a very speedy race. If she didn't quite get Radcliffe's record, could potentially be under threat in the next few years to come. But great marathon racing, and just bodes well for the rest of the summer. Coming up on the 5th and 6th of May, the IAAF World Race Walking Team Championships in Taichung in China.
Yeah, exciting. Yeah, it is really exciting. And there's been a lot on the website to kind of build up momentum for it. There's been the Way of the Walk series. And essentially, with race walking, you know, a lot of people don't really know the rules about it. And the Way of the Walk series essentially discusses things like loss of contact, the straightened leg rule, the carding system with race walkers, Jane Saville and Jefferson Perez. And yeah, there's some really interesting stuff on there.
So I think race walking is still this really intriguing world that a lot of athletics fans still don't know a huge amount about. So
no, I
was reading the series, and one thing I found particularly interesting was the straight leg rule, because personally I never understood the logic of having a straightened leg in a sport that involves movement. To me, it seemed so anti what you wanted to be doing. Surely the bent leg gives you the kind of cushioning, the momentum to go forward, but what do I know? I read about it, and it's really interesting because it's all about kind of generating power from your hips and getting forward sort of motion, and it's really fascinating. And I just thought that was something that I really should have known after reading.
For any of you who are interested, there is loads on the website at the moment, so if you want to catch up and read some of that ahead of the championships, then definitely go ahead and do so.
Now, last week, Ben was fortunate enough to catch up with ex-Olympic race walker turned lawyer, recent father and now chair of the Athletes Commission, Iñaki Gomez. Now, many people may not know too much about the Athletes Commission. The term has been thrown around a lot, but we wanted to find out what it actually means and the role it plays within the sport.
Some of the listeners may not know too much about the Athletes Commission, so if you could kind of sum it up in a few sentences, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, I think any athletes commission in principle needs to be the advocates for the athletes. You know, I think there's always been, or not always, but there's been a tendency to assume that, you know, just because there's the IAAF at the start of that, you know, name, the IAAF Athletes Commission, that we don't always represent the athletes in the best interest. But, you know, we were elected. That's a big difference than being appointed. And so, you know, our stakeholders are the athletes. And to the extent that the athletes want us to do something, say something, we're here for them, and they need to come to us with recommendations, questions, suggestions, issues. And then we can then mobilize and use our advocacy skills to either, you know, talk directly with SEB or go to the council or, you know, in the various commissions or working groups that we're part of, actually voice those concerns so that when decisions are being made that impact the athletes and the sport in general, they're being done in consideration with what, in consideration of what the athletes have to say, and not just sort of arbitrary decisions that never really took into account what the athletes think.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a really important thing to have within a sport. I think an interesting question that I don't particularly know about is, how did you specifically get involved? Because you are now the chair of the Athletes Commission. So how did you go from not being a part of it at all to now being the chair?
Yeah, I mean, I've joked about this with my wife, just sort of how things lined up one way or another. You know, like I said, I've been involved in similar roles in Canada, Athletics Canada. I've been the athlete director for, this is going to be, my term's ending shortly, but for 4 years. And then I got in a similar role at the Canadian Olympic Committee. And, you know, it's built some of the skills and attributes that are, I think, positive and made me a successful advocate for athletes. And, you know, via my role at Athletics Canada, I was invited to be part of the IAAF Governance Reforms Forum that took place in Amsterdam shortly prior to Rio. And so, you know, I was training in St. Moritz one weekend, and then I got this message, you need to come here. And so I flew over to Amsterdam for the weekend and took part in this forum and, you know, sort of made my voice and my presence noticed and started speaking about the things that need to be thought about when making decisions and how, you know, whether it's the governance reforms, how the athletes need to be at the center of it. And you know, it's interesting and the timing is right that, you know, I'm coming in here and other athletes that have also been elected that have similar views are coming in with, while there's a precedent that is much more athlete-centric and has pushed reforms that really put the athletes at the center of all decisions so that, you know, we're actually involved in various commissions that have an impact in the day-to-day of our sport. So just in more short, yeah, that's how I kind of got involved in the IAAF initially and sort of stayed in touch with a few members of the working group that do the reforms and sent my comments. And you know, over time, I was sort of encouraged by my federation, you know, if you're going to be more involved, you should put your name for the IAAF Athletes Commission. And by that time, I had already retired, so it was in London, and, you know, put my name forward. And fortunately, I was elected by my peers. And, you know, within a year, I thought, you know, might as well go all in and put my name for the chairperson.
Oh, wow.
That's where I'm here now.
How does an athlete become a part of the Athletes Commission?
Yeah, so there's, because it's an elected role, you know, every 2 years, there's sort of an overlap of six members coming in and six members going out. And so at every major world championship, so every 2 years, the athletes get the opportunity to vote for six new members to replace the outgoing members. And so, yeah, that's how you get involved. And the idea is that the athletes have the say on who is representing them. And, you know, hopefully the people that do get elected take the opportunity to seriously and actually advocate on behalf of the athletes. And like I said, I think we have some really strong new candidates that were elected that are very keen to get involved. And, you know, in our initial meeting in Birmingham, have sort of expressed specific interest in different areas. And I think we're going to utilize each athlete's strengths to make sure that we have the right people in the right groups to make the right decisions.
Who are the new athletes that were elected in London?
Yeah, so we have a number of athletes that have been elected. So we have, you know, Kim Collins was elected, Adam, and I apologize for my butchering of names, but Kazasut.
Kishot.
Kishot,
yes. Yeah.
Benita Willis.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, all so those stars. Are among some of those, and obviously there's a few others. And so, again, I think it's important to have fresh new faces, people that want to be active and want to make a difference. So that's our role, and we'll do our best to do so.
How often do you guys meet up throughout the year?
So me trying to learn more about how it was done in the past, and I know Rosalie did a really good job, and so now we're trying to formalize things a little bit more, and we're going to have hopefully a meeting, probably a conference call meeting next month to set up a sort of strategic plan and actually identify dates that where we can have calls on an ongoing basis. And then in-person meetings we'll have sort of two, I think, just, you know, cost-effective and also the fact that people are competing all around the world. Yeah. And from time to time, we're, you know, answering questions and consulting on issues via email. So it's a quite active role, but I think we can do it even more effective. So that's on me and Valerie to do our part to guide these guys.
Yeah, how do you feel about working now with Dame Valerie Adams as your deputy chair?
No, I mean, she's a legend in our sport. And you know, I think hearing her speak at the initial meeting where she sort of talked about some of the things she wants to work on, I feel very comfortable having to share this role with her and be able to work with her over the next 2 years to make a difference and bring the athletes' interest to the organization. So yeah, it's going to be fantastic. I know she's also balancing, you know, family life, sport, and other commitments. So it really falls on each of us to help each other when we need to.
What an interesting man. I think he's very considered. He obviously puts the athletes at the forefront of everything he does. And it was really interesting to just get a bit of an insight there into the work of the Athletes Commission.
The first Diamond League of the season, Doha Outdoors, is officially starting.
I'm so excited already.
And there's been some crazy matchups lined up already.
There has. Tell us more.
Well, Shippers versus Elaine Thompson. Which Elaine Thompson will turn up? And Shippers has kind of been kind of ropey indoors. Like, wasn't
her... Shippers is always a little bit ropey indoors. I mean, she's not got the best start, has she?
No. Yeah, she's a 200 meter runner primarily.
And
I'd
she needs
say.
That last 60 meters. Oh, gosh. Gotcha. That's my point.
There's also, as well, Roller versus Vetta. German javelin madness again.
That's going to be crazy.
What do you reckon? Like, last year, it was all about the men's javelin, but. Whilst I think those two are great, men's long jump though, I think this year we saw them indoors. It was crazy the distances they were jumping.
Luve Manyonga has talked about getting to 880 this year, yeah. Which is it's mouthwatering prospects. And do you know what? I believe him. I feel it's there.
Yeah, me too. I totally
and
believe him.
What is so exciting is it's not him alone. It's not one athlete going out above and beyond. They are pushing him. It's so close right now. And what's so exciting is their characters and they want to put on a show. It's not just let's jump as far as I can. It's let's jump as far as I can and let's get everyone involved. I love it. It's so exciting. And I think that could be one of the big Diamond League back and forward competition. You won't know who's won it until the final event.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. Really excited for that. Also, one of the key face-offs of the Doha Diamond League is Mutaz Barshim in the men's high jump, facing off against the World Indoor Championship bronze medalist, Matthias Przybylko. And he was elated to get his bronze medal indoors. And I think he could be one of those athletes to watch because, you know, it takes a medal at a World Championships level for you to mentally elevate yourself almost into thinking, I can jump with the best of these guys.
Definitely.
And it'll be cool to see him challenging Mutaz potentially, along with Lysenko as well, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And who are your ones to watch this season then for the Diamond League, do you think?
My ones to watch this season is Curtis Marshall for the men's pole vault. He's still so young. He's 20 years old. And he's just came fourth at the World Indoors and has now won the Commonwealth title from Sean Barber. I mean, it was an amazing competition. And he's I just feel like he's got something about him this year, and I think he'll have a really good year on the circuit against the likes of Levillenay, Lissek, all of that. And the men's pole vault is stacked as well these days. So, super excited to see him compete. What about you? Who are your ones to watch?
So, I think one of them, we talk about her all the time. I think we're just a bit obsessed.
Total.
It's got to be Danielle Thompson-Dodd.
Yeah, totally fangirling over Danielle Thompson-Dodd. Love her.
She's, yeah, we don't even know how to say her name, but...
No, it's Danielle. It's Danielle.
Danielle? Okay, I'll go with that.
It is Danielle. She told me at the Morning Dawn. I had a conversation with her. She told me, no, because I initially called her Danielle, and then she explained how people always get her name wrong. Her name's Danielle, so there you go.
Okay, you win. But no, I think we can't underestimate. She's still young. She's only 25.
Mm-hmm.
She was a NCAA athlete in Ohio. She actually started out in sprinting. Would you believe? Jamaican athlete, thought there was only one route, found another one, now a gold Commonwealth medalist. I just think she could really be the next one to step up into Dame Valerie Adams's shoes, potentially. Or dare I say it, you know, it could be a great match-off this year between the two of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, she beat it to the Commonwealth titles, so...
She did, indeed.
Who knows what could happen? I mean, there's obviously Anita Martin would like a word as well.
I was going to say, we can't forget her.
And also...
she's the world indoor champion.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's also, I think what's nice to see in the women's sprints as well, there's countries coming through that aren't Jamaica, aren't the US, and not your stereotypical sprint
nations. Yeah.
Majinga Kambunji of Switzerland. It would be nice to see if she mixes it now on the circuit after dropping 7.03 in the 60 metres this winter. I'd like to see her go sub-11, potentially, and just mixing it with the Jamaicans and the Americans on the circuit. It would be nice.
Absolutely. And I suppose my pick of the bunch in terms of track racing then has to be Clarence Munyai, South Africa.
Yeah.
20 years old, broke Wade van Niekerk's 200-meter South African record, 19.69. Was slightly underwhelming, I thought, at the Commonwealth Games. Didn't really do a huge amount.
I wasn't sure whether there was something explaining his lack of form, because it was only a few weeks later. I don't know whether it was injury or something like that, or first proper major. I know he was in London, but I don't know. I don't know, but it'd be cool to see if he does mix it in the Diamond League circuit.
And I really hope he's one of those athletes that running that one big time hasn't almost come too soon. I think with some athletes, they run that amazing time and then it's almost a bit overwhelming. They lose it. I hope he's one that can back that up now with form across the summer. And it'd be really great while Van Niekerk's out just to see someone else step up and... You know, I'd love to see those two compete against each other now that he's taken his title away.
Definitely, definitely. It'll be, so such an exciting season ahead of us. And already it feels like so much has happened, but there's still so much to go. So exciting.
So one thing that's worth mentioning then, Ben, is the scoring system in the Diamond League. I think it's one of those things, the season comes around every year and everyone goes, wait, I don't understand. How's this person got here? What does this score mean?
Yeah.
How many events do you have to be there for? So explain to me, how does this work?
Essentially, how it works is there's the two finals in Zurich and Brussels, and it's about gaining the points to qualify for those finals. Now, athletes will build up points over the course of the circuit, competing at the different Diamond Leagues, slowly accumulating points, and the top athletes in each event will be invited to the final. At that point, the points are wiped to zero, and then it's whoever on that day is able to take the title. So if you win on that day, then you're going home with the Diamond League jackpot.
In a way, it's a real mix of, firstly, you've got to be
consistency
really
at the
consistent
start.
And pulling out those performances week in, week out.
But then it's anybody's
at
game
at the end,
the
you've got to be the one.
And
wow.
Like, we saw it with Shaunae Miller-Weibo last year. She had a rubbish time at London 2017. Well, she got a bronze medal, but not what she wanted.
How rubbish.
For her standards.
Yes.
And then she came to the Diamond League finals and won the 200 and the 400 and just ran away with loads of money.
Well, and it was similar with Mo Farah having that slightly, you know, no one saw him losing the 5,000 in London 2017. And then the following week in his final track race, pretty much... victory in the Diamond League by stumbling over the line.
Yeah.
That was exciting.
It is exciting, yeah. So I think, it's a really packed season that we've got ahead and it's going to be super, super exciting. Another thing that we should definitely talk about is the fan of the month. I know you're excited about this, Katie.
I'm super excited.
Basically,
I'm the fan of the month, Ben.
Yeah, no, this episode's fan of the month is Katie.
I win. Sorry, guys.
So, yeah, essentially, the IAAF fan of the month is you guys need to write a review to us and rate us. Preferably 5-star, but, you know.
But no, it's worth saying, isn't it? It's really important to us that we are providing content that you want to listen to.
Yeah.
And that you find interesting. And we just want to know what you want from us. And if you let us know and review us, you could be in with the chance of winning some IAAF goodies.
Yeah. And if you're particularly nice to us, I mean, you don't have to be nice, but we take it constructive criticism as well. But yeah, leave a review, rate us, and then... we'll go through, and for the next episode, we'll pick the IAAF fan of the month. Also, if you've got social media, leave your Twitter handles and Instagram handles, whatever, and we can give you a shout out as well, just so we can ID you and that kind of thing.
Now, for our athlete interview this week, we've got something just a little bit special for you guys. I'm incredibly jealous that Ben got to talk to the legend that is Dame Valerie Adams about everything, and I mean everything. So have a listen. This is a really candid look back at her career right from the beginning. There's heartbreak and there's battles along the way, but stay tuned because this is unmissable.
What was it like for you growing up? Were you a part of a particularly sporty family?
So I was brought up in South Auckland, and that's in New Zealand, and my mother had 3 girls, and my dad had multiple children, 18 of them.
Wow.
But I was brought up in a very humble, poor humble home, but there was one thing we always had, and that was so much love. We live in, I guess, describe it as the Bronx or the ghetto, but, you know, and that's where we were brought up. I was born in Rotorua, but brought up in South Auckland. And sports was a way for us to, was a way for me to express myself. I was actually really, really tall when I was quite young. I was 6'4" at the age of 12. And as you can imagine, it's actually quite hard being that tall at that age. Kids can be cruel, and they were. And the one place I did feel very comfortable and normal was on the sports field, and that was something and I was always quite into. So my mum's from Tonga, from the South Pacific, and my dad's actually English, from Bristol. So
oh wow,
yeah, from one side of the world to the other.
Yeah,
and I was born here in New Zealand in Rotorua, and basically my mum and dad. Didn't meet. It was an arranged marriage that my mum's uncle got her to marry my dad, and then in Tonga, and then moved over to New Zealand to give her family a better life. So she sacrificed her own, you know, wants and stuff for a better life for her family. So that just goes to show the type of woman my mum was.
Were you particularly close to your parents growing up?
Oh yes, definitely. My mum and dad actually divorced when I was quite young, so we were brought up majority of the time with my mum, and I had a very, very special bond with my mum. She was the rock of our family, and I absolutely adored her. She, you know, believed in me regardless of how poor we were. She managed to do so much fundraising to be able to get me to the 1999 World Youth Championships, and that was held in Bydgoszcz in Poland. And we didn't have much money. We had to raise $4,000, and this is someone that, you know, barely got $40 a week. So I don't know how she did it, but she did it, and with the help of our community to get me there. But sadly, I actually lost my mum when I was 15, and she passed away in my arms, and it was the most hardest thing I've ever experienced in my life. But, you know, I love her so much and, you know, miss her all the time. But I know one thing is that when she did pass, but before she passed, I, you know, made a promise to her that I'll make use of the talents and the genetic genes that I have to be the very best athlete I can, because that's the only way I could really repay her for sacrificing a lot of the family's funds for me to be able to get training. So, yeah, she was an amazing woman.
That's
amazing
incredible. Woman. That's so touching. Was it because of her that you kind of got into sports?
Yeah, I mean, she definitely supported us regardless of, you know, what we wanted to do. She supported us, and as I made my way through the track and field, you know, rankings, I guess, here in New Zealand, she saw potential in what I was doing. And after 6 months of just, you know, training twice a week with, you know, our local club coach, I qualified for the World Youth Champs. And we didn't know what that was or anything, and we didn't know where Bydgoszcz or Poland was. But one thing she did do was she believed in me and gave me that opportunity. Regardless of how poor we were, she could have easily said, look, sorry, Ada, we know we don't have the money to do this, but she actually, you know, worked very, very hard to be able to fundraise with the help of the community to do whatever she can to fund that trip. My mother herself wasn't very sporty. My father wasn't very sporty at all. He was a logging truck driver and you know, he was on the Navy ship from England, and my mother was basically, she served a mission, and basically in the islands, they just look after their grandparents and their parents, and that was her job. She was the oldest grandchild, so that was her job, and when she came to New Zealand, she continued to do that, looking after us kids, and she was a housewife and, you know, a mother, so to speak, but yeah, no, she's a champ.
Wow, I mean, that's so crazy that they did a fundraiser Kickstarter for you to get to the, was it 1999 World Champs?
Yeah, 1999 I was.
That's crazy. Where did you place?
13 years old. I was 14 and I placed 10th at those championships, and I went back 2 years later to the same championship. So this was in 1999, and in 2000 my mum actually passed away. In September, and you know, that just kind of boosted my motivation more. And interesting events like that, when they happen in one's life, you can either, you know, decide to, you know, do something with it and use your anger, I guess, or your hurt or your grief in a positive way, or you can fall, you know, off the bandwagon and do other stuff. I was very fortunate that I did take this road, and I went back 2 years later after my first World Youth Championships and won them and broke the championship record. So it was a massive motivation, but one thing I wanted to do was to make her proud, and, you know, hopefully I did by doing that. And the day she did pass away, the night before she passed away, it was the 15th of September, we were watching the opening ceremony of the 2000 Olympic Games, and we were watching it, you know, together on the telly, because it was in Sydney, the time zone was the same, like the same as New Zealand. And I turned around and I said to her, you know, one day I'm going to be there. And she kind of looked at me and smiled. And the next morning at 9 a.m. she passed away. So a very memorable moment, very hard moment, but a very memorable moment.
Wow, that's so incredible. Obviously, if you'd known the incredible success you'd go on to have, and especially within the Olympic movement, I mean, what an incredible story, almost as if it was meant to be, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's sad she's passed on and not been able to enjoy this ride with me, but I believe that she is enjoying this ride with me up there, and she's looking down and watching over us, and that's a very comforting thing to have. And I know now that I'm a mother, obviously that feeling is more so important, and it's quite incredible. But I believe she's still around, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. So you went to Debrecen, 2001 World Youth Championships, won gold, broke the championship record. 2002, yeah. You went to Kingston, Jamaica for the World Junior Championships and won gold again. Did you have any idea at that point whether this would translate into a senior career? Like, did you know the scope of what you could achieve? Or
probably not. But one, I think World Juniors was the one that I kind of thought, oh, you know, this could possibly be a career for me, maybe. Only because, like, the World Youth Champs, okay, it's under 18, whoop-de-doo. It's great at the time, it's massive, but then you go to World Juniors, obviously the competition's a lot more bigger and tougher.
Yeah.
And then I went to the Commonwealth Games 1 week after that, you see?
Yeah.
And when I went to the Commonwealth Games 1 week after that, I actually got second, so I was 16 years old, I actually got second there by 8 centimetres, but I threw further in Kingston. So my throw in Kingston would have won the Commonwealth Games.
Wow. And that was in Manchester, wasn't it?
Yes, in Manchester. Yes, correct. In Manchester. So, the World Juniors, to me, I guess, you could say, was the point where I thought, you know, holy crap, this, you know, this is actually pretty awesome. If I continue the way I am, who knows what could happen. But at the back of my mind, you always think about, like, back then, like, the Russians and the Germans and the all these big countries, all these massive throwers, you know, throwing bombs left, right and centre, and you know, I, obviously a little bit, not fearful, but, you know, the competition is going to be very, very stiff.
Yeah. I mean, how did you find going to Manchester? I'm from Manchester originally. How did you feel going to a multi-sport event like the Commonwealth Games as a 16-year-old as well? Were you 16 then?
Yeah. It was very exciting. It was very cold because we just came from Jamaica and it was, you know, very hot and humid and sunshine. We went to Manchester. It was very cold most days and it rained most days, but I guess that's to be expected. And it was an awesome, I guess, experience for me to have that team environment within the New Zealand team itself, you know, actually standing next to our, like, famous netballers and famous rugby players. And those are people that at that age, I was only 16, watching them on TV, they seem so, I guess, like, far from my own reach. And then all of a sudden, like, turn up to Commonwealth Games, they've got Irene Van Dijk over here and Linda Wagner, and they've got the Sevens boys and, you know, all these amazing athletes who I've always looked up, you know, looked at and watched it, looked up to on telly here in New Zealand. And here we are rubbing shoulders together at the Commonwealth Games. So that was quite a surreal, unique, bizarre experience for me, but very exciting at the same time, because it is the first time I've, I guess, competed against big senior girls, so to speak. It is really my first open international competition.
So I guess fast forward another year and you arrive in Paris for the World Senior Athletics Championships.
Yes.
Again, still really, really young, but this is the pinnacle of our sport. Everybody's there. All the senior ladies are there. What was going through your mind at that point in time?
Just dropping my pants. To be honest, like very scary. You know, you read about these athletes. You read about, you know, it's funny because, you know, top three are all done for drugs now, but but you read about these athletes and you watch them compete and just how phenomenal they are and how they, you know, work the circle and how quick they are. And it was quite the intense competition and intense experience, because you go into the core room and, you know, they've all got their own little, I guess, rituals or routines, and you go out to the competition. But I was kind of like the underdog, because nobody really cared about me. You know, I was just there. I know that my, you know, some girl from New Zealand competing against people over there who are throwing like 20 plus meters, and, you know, who am I? I'm never ever going to chase these girls. And it actually was quite interesting, because I think I walked in ranked, I don't know, top 20 or something, and I finished fifth, which I thought was quite, you know, incredible. I was very, very excited about that, finishing fifth amongst all these big, amazing athletes at the time. And I actually was thought, oh, wow, you know, this is pretty awesome. But it also gave me even a bigger motivation to try and get better. I think I threw maybe late 18s at that competition and finished fifth. So, yeah, quite the experience.
Yeah.
at my first World Champs.
Yeah, you mentioned like the core room and that kind of thing. Was there any particular athletes that were quite intimidating and that kind of thing?
Well, they all were. I mean, as I said, like, some of them didn't look very feminine at all. So, you know, those types of things are just kind of surreal. You read about it, you know, and you see it on TV, or you see them on a computer screen, but you never really see them in real life. And English is not necessarily their first language, and I'm, you know, they're not necessarily that friendly, but, you know, I respected the fact that they were there. I respected the fact that they were there to compete, and I was also there to compete myself. So I had to try and focus on my own, I guess, game plan going into the 2003 World Champs. So it was, you know, enjoy the experience, but stick to what I know and what I needed to do for me.
So I guess you had the experience of Paris. You had all the ladies were there, but then 2004 again, it's another step up for you in the Olympic Games in Athens.
Yeah, it was. Unfortunately, in Athens, however, I had appendicitis 5 weeks out. So I actually had surgery on my appendix.
Wow.
5 weeks out from competing at my first Olympic Games.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, and that was a bit of a blow. I was training so well. I had a really, you know, bad stomach pain. I didn't know what it was, to the point where I was crawling to the doctors, and then they diagnosed that it was appendix and sent me off to a private hospital that night, and I basically had surgery that night, and it was on the verge of bursting, but luckily it didn't burst, so they had to do a keyhole, 5 holes of keyhole, and I'm leaving it like a tube in there, and then, but I was in the hospital for about a week. What? And to be honest, while I was there, I was thinking my dreams of going to the Olympic Games is over. Like, you know, there's no coming back from this 5 weeks out. What on earth are you going to do? And while I was at the hospital, I had to do everything I can, I guess, to mentally try and stay as mentally calm as possible, knowing for a while that my health was the most important thing at that point in time. But, you know, in my mind, I was like, I've done all this training and I've, you know, worked really, really hard for this moment. And I felt like that it was all kind of taken away from me. And if you've had your stomach operated on, what happens is that your abdominals just will, like, hang. They don't connect and contract. So I looked like I was 9 months pregnant. Whoa. Which was not very flattering. But in saying that, I don't know how I did it. I made it to Europe. I trained my butt off once I got clearance. I made it to Europe, and I made it to the Olympic Games, which was an amazing, again, going into the Olympic Games village and seeing all these athletes. I mean, I kind of freaked out when I saw Yao Ming and just how massive he was, and rubbing shoulders with, again, New Zealand athletes who are just, you know, ex-Olympic champions and just amazing athletes. And all of a sudden, I'm amongst it all. Then I get the opportunity to go and compete in Olympia, where it all happened and it all started, which was just an amazing experience. And then I end up, you know, making the final for the Olympic Games, finishing ninth in the finals. But then now I'm sitting at fifth place after all that got cleaned up. So another stepping stone, another experience to kind of, you know, get under my belt. And to be honest, all these experiences really showed me or you know, gave me an idea as to what international competition was all about and what could go wrong, what could go right, what you need to be like, what you need to do, how your mental state's supposed to be. So it was tough going, but the same token, it really gave me a firm idea on what to expect next time. So then, obviously, from there, I was more well prepared for next time.
Obviously, like you said, there's so many lessons that you could have taken away from there, and I guess you did, because the next year you went to Helsinki, I believe, 2005, and you got on the podium for the first time.
Yes, and that was awesome. That was phenomenal. Like that was buzzy, because I walked in. I mean, and I've always said this my whole career, that rankings are irrelevant. Rankings are irrelevant. Doesn't matter if you rank them 1, 2, 3, 10, 12. It doesn't actually matter. And I proved that in Helsinki. And again, competing against all these, you know, Russians and Belarusians and Europeans, which, you know, who normally dominate the sport. And the events, I walked in with nothing to lose, except I know what to expect now. I know what I need to do. I'm a lot stronger and I'm a lot more experienced. So, you know, obviously my throwing is a lot better, which gives you confidence as well. And when you have confidence, that's a good thing, because you're not so timid by other people or intimidated by other athletes. And that was pretty awesome. And I threw a PB in the qualifying, and then I threw what if I didn't, you know, PB in the qualifying, would have PB'd in the finals, and I end up finishing third there. But now I'm a silver medalist now from Helsinki. So it was an incredible competition. I couldn't have asked for a better comp than what I did in Helsinki, because I basically fought to the bitter end, and I didn't, I guess, take much note this time around of the other throwers who were on paper so much better than I was.
Yeah, I mean, But still, you're still so young at this point, and there's still so much of your career that's ahead of you. I mean, that was crazy to be a world silver medalist at that age. And then, you know, fast forwarding again, you go to the Commonwealths for the second time, but this time you top the podium.
Yeah.
Was this your first senior global title?
Yes, first senior global title. The Commonwealth Games were in Melbourne, so it kind of felt like a home games. I did go into those championships as a favourite, so again, a different type of feeling or attention being put on me because you are the favourite. So obviously, the question is, are you going to win? Are you going to win? But I've always said that in rankings are irrelevant. I needed to make sure that I was best prepared as possible. And Melbourne was a great championship for me. I basically dominated the event from the start to the end. And it is like the friendly games, that the Commonwealth Games, so that was pretty awesome to be able to get back in that team environment with all the other athletes. And from Manchester to Commonwealth, I learned so much. And I guess how to be in the village, because in a village situation, you know, you can get overwhelmed with so much stuff that's happening in the village, and you can tire yourself out doing really silly things. So I was able to minimize all of that and really focus on what I needed to.
Good. I mean, and then I guess 2007, the year after, the beginning, I feel, of your domination of the women's shot put. You got a gold medal, your first world title in Osaka.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was incredible. That was phenomenal. I won the competition on the last row, and I knew I walked in rank number two, and the Belarusian was ranked number one. You know, she'd been hanging around for a while, and it's not over until it's over. And for with my very last throw, I you know, gave it all I got. But you know, 2 months before that, my father actually passed away, and that was a tough one to swallow because dad had stomach cancer, and he was very, very, very ill, and I wasn't going to go to a small comp that was happening in Japan in May, and he said to me that I needed to go. So I would go down every weekend before when training week was done, you know, right up until I left to Japan, and I said to him to wait for me when I get back because he likes to watch Godfather, and we'd watch Godfather 1 and 2, and we needed to watch number 3. And I said, oh, yeah, wait until I get home, and then we'll watch Godfather. He goes, yeah, no problem. So I went to Japan and did the competition on my way home. We stopped in Sydney, and then before getting to Auckland, and I got a phone call there that he wasn't doing too flash. So as soon as I got into Auckland Airport, I basically just sped my way down to Rotorua, which is about a 2.5-hour drive from Auckland. So I just taken a flight from Japan all the way back to Auckland, and I was just on this, I don't know, adrenaline and trying to get down to Rotorua as soon as I can. I got down there at about 8:30, and this was May the 1st. So I got down there at 8:30, and unfortunately my dad passed away at 10:30, and it's such a sad and horrible thing to happen, but I felt really blessed that he had waited for me. I was the last one to turn up out of all his kids, and he had waited, and that gave me peace that he had, you know, that he heard me, that when I came back, because I told him when I got to the hospital that it's okay now, that he can go because I'm here. And it was beautiful. He just, you know, kind of just slipped away. He went to sleep, and that was the end of that. So dealing with the loss of a parent is tough, and obviously I had to take some time off, but then having to try and come back to a big competition, I kind of drew, again, motivation from that, from him, and from a death in the family, which is obviously very difficult to take and to deal with sometimes. But I wanted to, again, make him proud and give it everything I got, and dedicated my medal to him. So another, I guess, type of motivation, type of inspiration, and something for me to turn something that's negative and use it in a positive light, so to speak, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. I guess you've got to channel the emotion somewhere, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And from Osaka, You then head back to the Olympic Games in Beijing 2008. And this time it's the real deal. You know, you're going in as world champion. This is almost like your moment. This is the pinnacle. This is everything a sports person strives for.
Yeah.
What was going through your head as you approached into Beijing?
Beijing was... It was an incredible games. I think I walked in ranked number two. No, actually three. And I knew that the two Belarusians were run in two because they had done pretty good, big throws in Belarus. And like any athlete, we check out the rankings and we see what people have done, right?
Yeah.
So I did that while we were in camp. And I was like, okay, sweet. I've really got to be at the top of my game. But before that, I had trained so hard since Osaka into Beijing. I'd lost quite a bit of weight, got stronger, got better technically, and just made sure that I was best prepared as possible leading into Beijing. And when we arrived in Beijing, it was I wasn't a snob. I wasn't as social as I normally was. I was very, very focused. Went to the food hall, had a munch, came back. Went to training, came back to my room, and basically that was me. I was so focused on being the best athlete I could be, and when it came competition day, that I needed to do everything and right from the word go, because it was, I guess, extra added pressure on me because I was ranked number one, I was reigning world champion, and I knew I had a fight on my hands, and I needed to make sure that I was in the best possible shape to be able to fight this fight. Mentally and physically. So I had nothing to lose in Beijing. I had nothing to lose, but I had everything to lose. And come the competition day, I have this don't F with me look on my face when I'm competing. And when that kind of comes on, that means business. I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to do a job. And once that face came on, and I think it was pretty much the world champs, I think, in Osaka were kind of really discovered it, and then it kind of came out in Beijing a lot more. But I was focused. I was determined to make sure that I put my best foot forward and give my best shot. And my tactics whenever I go to a championship or a competition is actually throw as far as more smash the crap out of the shot, because as I've always said that, and put the pressure on the other throwers. And I did that from the word go in Beijing. And it was a very... intense competition, because as you can imagine, round one, everybody goes through, then round two, right after round five, I was that's the last round for everybody to make changes within the medal tally and all the rest of it to see if we can switch places. But as soon as the last person threw, and I was the very last person to throw, and I knew I'd won, I just kind of cut the competition, told them not to throw anymore, and celebrated, because it, let's just say that it was such a massive, intense, stressful road to get there. But as soon as the competition was over and I knew that I'd won, the relief I felt was incredible, because the pressure on me to win, the pressure on me to throw well was all there, and to be able to pull it off is so massive that when it does happen, when it does go to plan, it's such relief just runs over my body, and that kind of hit me first, and then the celebrations, and then the happiness and the smiles came after that. So that was quite an amazing feeling. But then again, from Beijing up to London, the pressure just goes on tenfold, doesn't it?
So very sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. But do stay tuned for our next episode in a few weeks, where we'll be talking about a multitude of really exciting topics. We'll have the World Race Walking Team Championships from Taichung in China. We'll be speaking to Anaki Gomez again about that, as well as race walker Tom Bosworth from Great Britain. We'll also, of course, be discussing the start of the Diamond League in Doha. And finally, you can hear the second half of an exclusive interview with Valerie Adams.
So Katie, just so people can put a face to the name, tell people your social media and that kind of thing.
So my Twitter is at k_CroydonSmith. That's Croydon with an E. I know it sounds stupid, it is my middle name. I blame my parents.
Croydon?
Yeah, oh. I know. The Croydon, not Croydon, so I'm thinking, you know, I can save it.
Yeah, somehow. They did you dirty there.
Yeah, they didn't like me. But that's me. How about you?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at _BenHarlow. It's pretty simple.
Well, that's just a bit dull, isn't it?
But yeah, so do let us know as well. Mention us on Twitter. If you have any questions or want to give us any feedback, please let us know, because as we keep banging on about, we want to make this the best thing possible for you guys.
We'll see you next time.
Yeah, we'll see you next time, guys. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.